Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Greetings, family. We are about to embark on the one-year mark of Summit of the Moors. Summit of the Moors is a galvanizing event where we take all Moors from around the planet and we work on one particular agenda. And we have been working this agenda. And that agenda is three primary things: food, clothing, and shelter. Now, we are working on creating financial sectors owned and controlled by Moors in order to capture and create inheritable wealth for our children. We're talking about investing, partnerships, building, the application of controlling independent agriculture systems, real estate, housing, land, manufacturing, distribution, wholesale. These are the things that will make a nation. These are the things that will secure wealth for our children and our grandchildren's children. Summit of the Moors, January 10th through the 11th. Check us out on the website, summitofthemoors.com. Peace.
Welcome, Moors and Moors Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana Elbay, and this evening we'll be dealing with the coming African American Holy Cost. The coming African American Holy Cost. Now, this particular Holy Cost happens every year around the same time, and it goes directly into the next year, and it is quite interesting. And what we're going to deal with here this evening, we're going to deal with the following. What does the people of African descent in America have to look forward to on the next big financial holy cost? How much profits can they hope to gain? What have they learned since last December the 25th, 2012, if they continue on their present course of embracing another nation's customs and culture, what will become of them in the next 5 years? Will they continue to practice other nations' customs before this year ends? These are just a few of the questions that we're going to deal with, and there'll be much, much more, because what we're going to do is deal with this from every conceivable angle. We're not just going to deal with the Christmas aspect and the holiday aspect and all of that. We're going to deal with that. We want to look at the impact on people of African descent inside the United States, where we are now and what we are doing now, and what is the near future outcome for what's going on with us in this country. How do other people see the outcome as far as money is concerned and as far as debt is concerned as well? So notice I said two different things, because a lot of us, well, I ain't getting into all of that. But We also want to look at what are the politicians, the educated, the media, and all of these people, what do they think about the current situation? Because what is interesting to me is this, and I only want to deal with the facts. You know, I like to just simply deal with the facts. Now, based on the books and stuff that I have read, there were over 200 million people of African descent systematically murdered in cold blood. It's called the slave holocaust. Okay, so we cannot say that it didn't happen. So that's a fact, right? Okay. Now, but we have people who seem to think, who try to say that that's something that happens long ago, and, you know, this is a new age, and we never need to just forget all about that. That doesn't play any part in anything that's going on today. But I'm going to say today and tonight, just tonight, that, okay, you're correct. It doesn't. So that means that we are all even. The people who committed the murders paid for them. They went to prison. Or they were murdered just like the people they did murder. And if they weren't, then we need to try to figure out a way to make sure wherever their offspring is, that somebody pay for that, or the government, or somebody. And if that's not the case, then maybe we need to come up with something else. But either way it go, the murders have to be paid for. So we're going to put that little box right there on the side and just leave that sitting there on the side. And let's go on and see if there's anybody inside the United States that's profiting from the enslavement of another people. And what is it that is in place today that is perhaps keeping or not keeping someone away from getting in a position of power so that they can just be self-sustaining, if nothing else? I know that might seem kind of odd to you that I'm saying this and you're trying to put these pieces together and all that, but I want to look at this thing from every conceivable angle. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the murders didn't happen. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that there are people who do not benefit from the murders. There's nobody here to cut off minds and to derail or change the conversation in order to keep from facing the fact that this thing hasn't gone away. And I'm trying to figure out in my brain, based on what I know about my own self and the love and respect and admiration about my own self, based on what I know about my own self and my own culture and my own ancient story, and the fact that this is what I'm connected to and this is what brings joy and love and peace and respect and strength and lack of fear in me. So I feel like this is something that must be exported to other people, because I am a firm believer that if you have knowledge and you are acting upon the knowledge that you have, you can do some things. And by the same token, if you are fearful things, you don't seem to get very far. I don't know. I have never seen one man shoot another man in the back and be respected by the community and be held as a man. I have never seen that before. The era of time that I came from, if two men went to war with one another, face to face, toe to toe, and man to man, if one man pulled out a knife, not a gun, just a knife on another man, that man never was considered to be less than a man. But now, today, it seems almost natural and acceptable and respectable for men to be less than a man, and they are then rewarded for doing things and committing acts of being less than a man. Now, let me explain that to you. We'll take the generals inside the United States. They'll go on the ground, they'll plan a war, they get a telephone. And they own these telephones, and they're giving out orders of what to do over here and where this army need to go over there and all that to fight and take a chance on getting themselves killed, the men that's actually out there manning up, getting themselves killed. But then the generals who have not went and faced nobody come out of hole somewhere and go up on the ground and have a medal pinned on their chest and be elevated and call a general. Well, I don't understand that. I don't understand that. Now, the story that I heard was there was a gangster in Chicago. His name was Dutch Schultz. He had a problem with Bumpy Jonas, a brother. Dutch Schultz was killing Bumpy Jonas' men. Bumpy Jonas' men were killing their men. Everything was man to man. Bumpy Jonas said, well, look, I'm tired of all the bloodshed. He caught some of their men, and he said, look, I'm not going to kill you. He said, because I need you to go tell your boss that I say to meet me on the streets, and me and him go settle this man to man. Now, to me, that was a perfect opportunity. No men, no guns, no weapons. Just you and you. You're supposed to be the boss. You're supposed to be the man. Let's me and you, man to man. But when that happened, Dutch Jones told him, say, you go tell him, I ain't coming out of nowhere. I ain't coming. But you're telling all your men and you're telling all your wife and all these people that you're a man. So what is phenomenal to me today is what I see all over the United States, especially in the media and all that, masquerading as men is phenomenal to me. Amazing is going on.
Why blacks are losing ground? Why is it that the black unemployment rate is getting higher and worse, and dropout rate is worse than they actually tell you? Because, you know, the media only tells you half of the story. The other half is that things are much worse for blacks in America than anybody realized. I mean, they have the blacks on TV, you know, the token blacks and sitcoms and the buddy movies, you know, with the blacks standing side by side with a white man and all that, or the Chinese man. But the fact of the matter is that the situation for blacks in this country is deteriorating almost every day, and you see the crime rate going up. But it's not just the crime rate. It's just you have this basic population that lives almost outside of society. It's almost like a totally outside of the main force of what propels the society forward. And the reason why that is because as more and more Asians and Hispanics have taken over this country, especially the administrative elements of cities, schools, and you know what have you, companies, they are not so enthusiastic about affirmative action and special treatment for blacks. Okay, I mean these people are not gonna be pinned down about some slavery that existed 100 and 200 years ago. I mean these people will say they had nothing to do with it, so they don't have to pay any price for it. So you have a lot of these companies owned by Hispanics and Asians that are simply saying, we're only going to hire either people like us or we're just not going to hire people who will not do the job. And, of course, that usually means they're not going to hire blacks. And that's why you are seeing less and less, for instance, of cab drivers. You know, it used to be cab drivers that were practically all black when the Irish stopped driving cabs. So the blacks took over. Now, it's Hispanic, Asians, you know, Eastern Europeans. You're seeing more and more in companies where instead of hiring black clerical work that used to work in places like, you know, the mailroom or the file clerks and, you know, the what they call assistant to the technicians or technical assistants, you know, whatever the name of it is, or just people who did the lowly stuff for a very small amount of money. Now you see more and more Hispanics taking over, more and more Asians are taking over those kind of jobs, and also the food industry. I mean, you used to walk in some of those food enterprises like Wendy and McDonald and Burger King, and it was practically all black. You know, now you begin to see more and more Hispanic, more and more Asians just, you know, taking over, and just they don't want black people to handle food that white people eat and everybody else eats. So we begin to see that the blacks in this country, even though you have people like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton saying things like, well, you know, America is becoming less white, as though like that's supposed to be something good, as though that's going to help black people. The fact of the matter is that it's not going to help blacks, that when if America is becoming less white, that's true, but it's not becoming blacker, it's becoming browner, okay? And these people, these brown people, they're not going to sit back and take any bullshit about affirmative action and set-aside programs and special treatment for blacks. And so you begin to see a new direction that this country is taking. And I think this will lead to more riots or more type of social disorder. And you can see it already in the black community where these people have totally lost any hope that they will go forward and they will you know, be part of the economy and even the political life of their community, because when they do become the main actors in the cities, let's say like Detroit, they only inherited a wasteland. I mean, Detroit and other so-called black city are nothing but wastelands. And so that's going to be the future of America. And one wonders what this will lead to, you know, whether blacks have learned the lesson that, you know, riots are not going to do them any good, and that they know that white people and Hispanics and Asian will not take any abuse and they will go on the offensive and basically any threat of racial rights against anybody will mean that cops will just take out guns and start shooting, you know, because they're not going to take the bullshit anymore. So This is kind of an interesting development in America lately, and put your comments as you please, and let me know how you feel about it, whether you have any theoretical ideas, and so on.
Okay. At this point, Morris, that was quite interesting. If anybody got any comments about what this gentleman just said, go ahead and raise your hand. We'll open up the phone lines. The phone lines are open now. So go ahead and raise your hand, and we'll open them up. Okay?
Major or minor investors or the rich, including the media, is not broadcasting to you the act of discharging debt or how to cancel your mortgage, student loan, or deal with the Internal Revenue Service. For the solution to all of the above, go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com. That's www.newfreehelpgroup.com. But before you do anything, contact Tahaka, T-A-R-H-A-K-A, T-A-R-H-A-K-A, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Okay, we're back. Now, that was quite interesting. Gentleman said that this is what I'm getting from what the guy's saying. He's like, you're in the condition that you're in, and all the Asians up in here, and if you start anything, the cops are going to just start shooting you down, and so you just stuck. That's just it. That's just the bottom line. So that is to me, that is not a good situation to be in. That's not a good situation to be in. I'm not upset about that. It was very, very interesting to me because a lot of stuff I hear people say and a lot of their thinking, and based on what they see or what they think things would be like is their opinions. So there's no need for me to get upset about anybody's opinion. But I do like to hear what other people think about this different situation, because I also find out, based on what people are telling me, what they think. I had a very interesting situation today, and a lot of you all have heard me talk about the little structure for your little financial structure, where you put your income at the top and your expenses and assets and liabilities, and you do the little scenario how to pay yourself from each dollar. And I talked to two Christian gentlemen today, and I only asked them to give me their opinion on what I was about to show them. And I drew it out perfectly. And after showing it to them, they say, well, one guy said, well, actually, it's not going to work. I said, well, why don't you think it'll work? Because if it ain't got Jesus, because you didn't mention nothing about the church, you didn't mention nothing about a donation to the church, you didn't mention nothing about God, and you, I said, so you think that it won't work? I said, well, what did you think, brother? So I asked the other brother. He shook his head. He didn't say nothing. So I said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go and tell the millionaires that I got this from that they're going to have to give back all of their millions of dollars, because, and I need to write down your name, sir. Why don't I give you so I can tell them who it was, and say this, so we can get them over here so you can tell them what you just told me. You're going to go to hell. Oh, man, it was a riot. I had a good time today with that one. But anyway, it's amazing how we think things. But I found out that if you do research and you read and you investigate and do research on certain things, that your thinking is quite different. you discover that you have a different opinion about things when you're putting worthwhile information in the brain. Now, if you're loaning your brain out, or you're leasing your brain, or renting your brain to another apparatus, information in the brain that they control, now we have a problem. We have a serious problem. Because what's coming out of our mouth now is something from the opinions that somebody else has formed for us, and we have allowed them to be stored in the brain. A lot of us maybe haven't thought about that. You watch television and all day, especially on Sunday, and but you think, hey, I got this in. I'm all right. I'm under control. But how could you be under control when you've loaned your brain to a device that has programmed it with somebody else's thinking, somebody else's culture, somebody else's custom? All this has been recorded by the brain. And what's in the brain is going to formulate and is going to eventually come out. Most of us think that we can loan and lease and rent our brain to some other apparatus and then have some type of control of thinking. But you can't. You're going to have to control that. Otherwise, you're out of control. That's just the bottom line. If we understand the workings and the control of the brain, then we can make some progress. To give you an example of what I'm talking about, we're going to say that you took just 3 days, and you have said to yourself, look, I'm taking total control of the brain, and the reason why I'm taking total control of the brain is because the brain is attached to my shoulders, and I walk around with it every day. I'm not going to loan it out to nobody, just me. I'm going to set aside a space of time where I'm going to do some investigation. I'm going to do some reading. I'm going to look up meaning of words. I'm going to understand these things. I'm going to file them in my brain. I'm going to remember them, and I'm going to file them. Okay, just 3 days. You will discover that your thinking will change. When somebody says something stupid, there's no need to get upset, because you automatically know it's stupid before they even finish the sentence. It's amazing. You ought to try it out. Just run a test. See, we done got out of the experimental mode. We have gotten away from experimenting. We thought that when we left school that everything that we learned in there, that was sufficient. The only thing we could say now is that I have a high school diploma, and then I have a degree. Okay, but how much control have you had of your own brain since you left there? What have you been allowing to be put in there? How much control of it have you had? How much dictation have you put in it? How is it possible for people to write books and you haven't? How is it possible for people to do many, many great things and you haven't done these things? But you have a degree. And you discover that the people that have the college degrees and all this stuff, they have come to the conclusion that they are wasting their time. I heard one man say, there's no doubt in my mind that if you get a college degree, that you would definitely get a job. But when you begin to educate yourself, you become wealthy. That's what he said. So that tells me one thing. He had loaned his brain to somebody else to be infiltrated with information which he thought would propel him toward freedom. Because when I say rich, I'm talking about freedom. freedom. But he finally realized that with all the degrees that he had, it wasn't enough. He began to go out and learn from the other people who had realized the same thing and start using his brain and programming his own brain and dictating and doing the policies and stuff that he needed to do himself and to put the information in the brain that he decided to put in there. And when he did that, then he was ready to begin the journey toward freedom and become free. So let's take a look tonight at what we have leased the brain to. We're going to do that, and we're going to look at some other stuff too. But if we understand the equations that I'm talking about now, because this is a very, very simple equation. I mean, you're in your environment, and especially if you're in there by yourself, you are forced to be alone with your own thoughts. Now, that is dangerous for a lot of people. A lot of people are fearful of that, being forced to be alone with their own thoughts because they are forced to think. And what a lot of people do in that situation, when they find themselves alone, they'll cut on the TV, or they'll run over there and get on the internet, or they'll cut on the radio, or they'll go back and cut on the TV, or they'll take a nap. Anything to keep from thinking, anything to keep from being faced with the reality of your own thoughts and the programming of your own brain. That is amazing, a phenomenon, because everything that we are experiencing today is taking place right there in that spot called the brain. Right there. It's all happening right there. You are where you are in this life because of the actions you have or have not taken. That's the bottom line. If you are constantly allowing some other entity or apparatus to program the brain, it is formulating your beliefs and your thoughts and your actions as a result of what you allow to happen. But when you shut it down and you start investigating for yourself and doing the research for yourself and reading for yourself and studying for yourself, now you have control. And if you've got control, you can spot BS a mile away. When something pop up, you can smell it all the way across the street because you have control of the brain. Your thinking is not the same as everybody else's thinking. You're not going for a whole lot of junk because that's not what you know. You might find yourself wrapped up in something because, see, what happens is a lot of times people who are out of control and have no control of their thinking, have no control of their lifestyles, and don't know where they're going, and have no plan, have no structure, what these people do when they recognize that you do, they will attempt to attach themselves to you and hold on to you and drag you down in the muckety muck. When they realize that, hey, the joke is, the jig is up, the game is over. When you call them on the telephone, or when they call you, I'm sorry, when they call you on the telephone, they say, well, happy Thanksgiving. Oh, hold it, brother, right there, I'm sorry. I don't participate in that because that don't have anything to do with me and my culture, but I appreciate it. Well, we were going to invite you. I'm sorry, I have to decline. I've already replaced it with another custom that's indigenous to my own culture. So I guess you don't celebrate Christmas. Oh God, no, I have to taste good. I'm sorry. I've already found out the truth about it, so I have to refrain from it. Well, what about Jesus? Can you tell me how could it possibly be somebody named Jesus who lived in the first century when the alphabet J covered it to the 16th century? That's impossible. Well, I appreciate you explain it to me. But go ahead and take care of that. I'm going to have to refrain from that. But I appreciate you calling. Okay, so now these people have a problem. Because he's trying to run. Malvin, he's trying to run. We gotta drag him down. I'm going over there and talk to him because he done gone crazy. He just don't do nothing. Nobody do. He losing his mind. Y'all need to go over there and check on him because he done lost his mind. In other words, the fact that you have taken full control of the brain that's attached to your shoulders, and you have done an investigation and overturned every rock and identified the facts and separated the facts from fiction, they have a problem, and you are the enemy. And this thing is serious. We have a serious situation when that happens. Now, if you don't believe me, pay attention. Because this is exactly what happens when you begin to practice what you believe based on the facts that you can present. Now, these same people, they are going to fight you tooth and nail when you begin to provide evidence of the facts that cannot be denied. When you attempt to not only state your position and back it up with facts that's been put into print or any other kind of way by credibility-owned authors that are impeccable. They will fight you and fight you and fight you. They will attack you. They will discredit you. They will keep you from presenting your side and presenting your evidence. They will discredit you, and if you're not careful, they will attack you. That's how damaging the system is of these people allowing their brain to be controlled by something else other than them. It's just that serious. You have no idea. All you have to do is run a few tests. Run a few tests out there, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, and see what happens. And you will find out that the biggest attacks will come from the people that you've been knowing all your life, and even the people that you raised up in the house with, that you've known all your life. Your own family will be your biggest attackers, even though you got all the facts and nobody on the planet can discredit the credibility of the authors that presented the facts. The facts can be examined from every conceivable angle and they will stand straight up all the way to the heavens and cannot be overturned. And because of that, you will be attacked from every conceivable angle. You'll be discredited, and if you're not careful, you will be attacked by the very people in your house. That's a crying shame. I try to think about the story of the guy that they are calling Jesus today in the so-called New Testament. When he said a prophet is not welcome in his own hometown. The people right around him, right in the same community, in the neighborhood, they were like, the fame and renown and all this right here was going on, and it could not be disputed. There was nobody in the city that can actually overturn anything, but these people wanted him dead. We got to crucify this man because this man here, he is going against everything that we have taught because we have loaned our brain out and leased it out to somebody else and have allowed something else to formulate our opinions and all this right here. So we have no choice but to kill this man. But Pontius Pilate say, I find no evil in the man. What has he done? Crucify him. Crucify him. We not crucify him. That is quite amazing. And the same identical thing happens today to you. It happens to you. You can tell your family members, well, I no longer celebrate Christmas. Well, you've been celebrating all your life. Well, I no longer participate in Christianity because I have knowledge concerning what my ancestors in Africa and the Americas practiced prior to Christianity ever coming here, and there was peace and tranquility before it came, and after it came, there was chaos, murder, war, degradation, deprivation, and damnation. One of the most amazing paradoxes that I've ever seen in my life is men with weapons on somebody else's land kneeling down to pray at Christmas after killing somebody yesterday, and now we're going to pray today and observe a Christmas holiday, but tomorrow we're going to go out and start killing some more. But that's supposed to be normal. Isn't that amazing? That's quite interesting, isn't it? All you got to do is go on YouTube, go on to the history of World War II around Christmas time, and you'll be able to see them. Here's somebody went to somebody else's house to kill him. But when Christmas time came, we got to stop and pray, and then after that, we can go back to the killing. Same thing happened during slavery. I was reading the incident where this ship had went into Africa, and they had went out and captured all the slaves and loaded them up on the ship, and the captain, he had set sail, but then the captain discovered that they had kidnapped it. Slaves on Sunday, which he considered to be God's holy day. So he turned the ship around and made them turn them all back loose and told them we got to go back out on Monday and re-kidnap and bring them in. But we can't do it today. Woo! My goodness. Boy, this is amazing. You don't have to take my word for it. Go read a book called Introduction to African Civilization by John G. Jackson. Now, before you read the book, I need you to type into Google the name John G. Jackson and examine his credibility. So therefore, if we start there, that will determine for us whether or not we even need to go and read anything about John G. Jackson. And you may want to examine the works of John Henrik Clark. But before you read any of it, let's examine the credibility of the author, which will determine whether or not we even need to learn anything about it. Because if he's not a credible person, if he's bogus, we don't need to learn anything about that. Now, do we? it's amazing to me because I have men sometime, and these are men who look just like me. It's amazing because I know that the brain has been loaned out or leased out or whatever to someone else, and they want to have a dispute. And I always stop them about the dispute because I like to just simply quietly lay the information out and methodically, quietly, let them come to the realization of their own selves and try to always get somebody to make sure that the door is locked so that there can be no escape and get a commitment from them to allow me to be, come before all the people who believed in them so that I can expose the same thing to them. And, of course, I'm never allowed to. And haven't been attacked, but I have been threatened and shut off and shut down and closed out and put out because I refuse to loan my brain out for indoctrination to someone else. But it's quite amazing. All you have to do is just check it out. It's interesting. If you would just take the time to examine things. I've been to different sites. I went to it was an all European site on Facebook, and they had it was a history site, and I began to read stuff that they were calling history, and you know it was saying a lot of good stuff and all of that. But I began to post some information, you know, to add my little 2 cent worth. Well, needless to say, less than 8 hours, I was banned from the site. I was attacked. I was discredited, and I think because I was so patient and kind and relaxed at presenting the facts and the truth, that I was attacked the most, and I asked the moderator to be so kind as to call the person that he believed in, if he had a college professor, or if he knew the Pope, or if he knew the person that the Pope believed in, if he would bring them so that he could bring what he had, and I would just lay what I had out before him so that he could dispute it. And I was immediately thrown out. But I think that if it was under different circumstances, I probably would have been crucified. So, we'll be back in a moment.
Prior to the turn of the century, 95% of the people inside the United States were self-employed. Immediately after the turn of the century, we got 95% of the people working for just 5% of the population. What happened? Well, we have a lot of people that pay attention to television. You'll see your politicians will come on there and they'll talk about the problems that we have, and then they're talking about they're doing everything that they can to make sure that we provide more jobs. Well, if you're providing more jobs, common sense tells me that there'll be more and more people that are working for somebody else. When are you going to tell us about the people who are self-employed, you know, like the 95% in the beginning when we were prosperous people? But that's not the case. However, what we're here doing is we're providing you an opportunity to be an employer instead of an employee so that you can provide opportunity for other employers to be self-employed. Go to www.TahakaPowernomics.net. That's www.TahakaPowernomics.net. Once you sign up for the Platinum Matrix, you can receive absolutely free Tahaka Archives Master Library. We'll give that to you absolutely free as a result of you taking responsibility for your own self and then becoming an employer instead of an employee.
Area code 719. Tell us who you are, what your questions or comments.
Islam, Tucker.
Hey, what's going on, man?
How you doing?
Well, boy, look here, like you was finna start running for the Cincinnati Bengals. What's going on, man?
Actually, I was just tuning in, and I'm driving down the street. I must hit a button. I didn't have a question. I'm trying to catch up with them.
Okay, well, what's your comment about what we're discussing here today?
Excuse me?
What's your question about what we are discussing here this evening?
Oh, no. What I was saying is I just tuned in. I must have hit a button. I'm trying to catch up to see what you are discussing here today.
Okay. Well, you're going to have to hold on for that. Just hold on a minute, and we'll open up this next line. Area code 443. Tell us who you are, where you calling from, what's your question and comment. 443.
Hey, now I'm just calling in, just tuning in. Listen, this is Brother Fort Sumter Bay. Yeah, just listening.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, tell us about Fort Sumter, man. Tell us about it. What is it? What is it about?
Well, you know, a lot of my family is from there, so my last name being Sumter, I just, you know, that's my name.
Okay. Well, I mean, I know
it's
you.
A little different.
Do you know about the history of the Sumter family? Could you give us something about that? Because that's an interesting name.
Yeah. No.
Well, let them know about it. Give us a little background, a little brief background on the Sumters, man.
Well, we got a big, very, very huge type family going on. It's like some of them, they came from, as far as from what I know, you know, they said from Africa, India, settled in Trinidad. From there, they spread out a little bit from those islands into the surrounding islands. Then from there, a few of them came here, New York and South Carolina. And then they just populated. And then here I go. That's the brief up. That's the brief version.
Okay. Well, I tell you what. Tonight we're gonna give you some information, and in your opinion, now I need to ask you this now. In your opinion, do you think that if you get enough good information, that you'll be willing to gather the Sumter family and straighten them all out, so they'll see it your way?
We tried. Tried, but you know you got to try and try again, so I'm willing to try it. I never throw in the towel. Because you know what? It's like, yo, I looked at the topic, man. We got this serious, man. You say that holy cost. It is a holy cost, and we tired of paying the price.
Well, now, we got to, in order for us to get out of something, we had to know what we're getting out of. And see, what I'm trying to do right now is explain to the people how they got in the condition they're in. What happened? And then after we get to that part.
We did that already.
Hmm?
Yes. We did that already. You know, we brought up the issue of the fact that we're the only people, like you got Chinese people, they have pride, and they uphold their own things, and they stand behind each other. You got the Mexicans, they have pride in themselves. And every other race,
but why do they,
us, we the only people.
Why do they have pride, though? But why they got pride in Israel? What do they have that we ain't got?
All I know is we the only people that don't love ourselves and hate each other, and we don't have the pride, and we actually live, you know, somebody else's culture better than they do as far as this American thing. And that's what's killing us, you know. That's the death of us, you know.
Well, you know what? I found out that I do it upon myself, because it was, you know, when I was in my 20s, I used to go out to the nightclub and stuff, but a lot of times I used to go by myself, but I had brothers who would come around the house. Man, we got to go get my brother, man. We going up to the club. All of us going to go up to the club. But when they came around to the house, my mama would stop them at the door and say, he's in there in them books. He got books stacked to the ceiling, and he ain't coming out. So I done already told him y'all was out here, and he looked at me like I was crazy over them glasses. So y'all need to come back another time. And they were like, oh, we understand. I know him. We understand. So he got the car left.
Yes.
I haven't stopped that habit, because I made it a habit of investigation. You can't, if you try to tell me something, and something that you claim to believe in, and it's supposed to be all this right here, okay, that's fine. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm going to go and investigate it. But the next time I see you, we need to have a meeting.
Yes, sir.
All right, brother. Switchboard, let me go. I appreciate you, brother, something.
I appreciate you. I like what you're doing. I've been a supporter for a minute. That's why I had to call tonight. You know, I know they don't have that much time, but yeah, I just called to really listen, you know, so.
All right, well, buckle your seatbelt because we're going for a ride tonight.
All right, brother.
All right. Eric Cole, 216, tell me who you are, where you calling from, what's your question or comment?
Islam.
Islam, Mo, what's going on, man?
How you doing? This brother, Ross Seggy, man, called up out of Cleveland, Ohio. And, I just wanted to chime in. I just wanted to chime in on a little bit of why, you know, black people here in America of African descent is in the condition that we're in is because we don't know nothing about nationalism. And that's what a lot of these other ethnic groups actually participate in. Like you take Chinese people, for instance, come Christmas time, they don't shut down nothing. They still open selling chicken, shrimp fried rice. You know, they all about business. And that's something that, you know, we know nothing about. We don't, like you say, just nationalism, period. You know, you ask the average Christian, they know nothing, absolutely nothing about that. You know what I'm saying? So, and all these other ethnic groups, that's all they do is practice nationalism on us, and it just merging, just coming our neighborhoods and merging us all day long. You know, so
you know what I think it is.
What's that?
I don't think it's complicated. Mm-hmm. I think what done happened is they done already find out that it's a whole nation full of people that's doing the wrong thing, and as a result of it, they can benefit from it. All they got to do is come over here, bring their food, their culture, open it up in our neighborhood, and just sit back and wait for us to come in there, and don't say nothing, just serve them. I don't think the reason why I say that, because I have yet to see any Korean or any Chinese or any Japanese run out the back of the kitchen and bust through the crowd of black people that buy their food and say, "You stop, you have to understand that this is about nationalism," and run back in the back and go back to washing dishes. I have never seen it happen. I only seen them just, "Hello, hi, what, if we young, okay, and write it to me, that's $20. You know, that's all that.
But they do it. But see, they do it. You know, they practice it without even having to do that. You know what I'm saying? Because like I say, we over here participate in all these European holidays, functions. We go to all the European birthdays, holidays, functions. We go to all their stuff. You know, we at St. Patrick's Day Parade. What are we doing at St. Patrick's Day Parade?
I think what would really cause a ruckus is, and you have to use your imagination for this, guarantee you, all the Chinese in the United States will go down to the white folks and be ready to go to war with them if all the black folks just wake up and just say, wait a minute, all I got to do is just refrain from participating in your culture and just start embracing mine and go back to the same thing we were doing yesterday and just yesterday in the 70s and the blacking them pride and the patronizing one another. The Chinese will run downtown, all of them. It'll be thousands of them down there. They'll be protesting. Come outside. You told us these people were stupid. They done stop being stupid. They ain't buying nothing else no more. We got to leave America. You owe us some visa money. Let us...
Absolutely. And that's right. And see, that's why they get directed to our neighborhoods, because, you know, they got us paid. They know what's up with us. You know, they say, okay, you go over there and set up shop. You might have to take a robin or two, you know, but other than that, you can make a killing off of these people. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they just want to be merchant. You know, they can't run. Mm-hmm. They can't do this themselves, you know. I think the government actually do that for these people. You know, some type of incentives, you know, to come to our neighborhoods and set up shop.
Well, I know that you're absolutely correct, because we ran an experiment in real life You are absolutely correct, because this is what I did. I managed a Jamaican restaurant for almost 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I ran it so long, and when nobody in there but Jamaicans, and in order to relate to them so they can understand what I'm saying, I had to kind of like talk Jamaican, and they understand what I'm saying. You know, they were like, hey, man, what's going on in that, man? What do you want, man? So after 3 years of this, thought they were paying me good. I say and say you want to say. Just give me. So what I did was I went to down the street as I got off of work, and I had came up with this idea that I'm going to make R&B music from old school, put it on tape, and the area that I was living in, they was upset by this and rap. And all this stuff, I said, I'm going to bring my tapes out, and I'm going to make a killing. And so I was making these tapes. But my box broke down. So I went to the Caucasian guy pawn shop. And I went in there, and he said, he saw me walking there with a tuxedo and brought over daylight. I just got off of work. I said, how you doing, man? He said, oh, I'm doing all right. I said, okay, man. I said, I'm looking for I need a boxing man. He said, you from Jamaica? I said, yeah, man, managed the Jamaican restaurant right on 45 West Monroe, man. Oh, yeah, new to, oh, yeah, okay. He said, what you want? I said, need a new box, man. How much you want? He said, hey, man, don't even worry about it. He said, I'm going to give you this right here. I said, well, I'll trade this in, man. I said, trade this in, hey, man. He said, just take that, just set it over there, and you just take it right here. You don't owe me nothing. Okay, so I took the box, to the venue man, and I walked out. But I came back after I got the box. When I came back, I walked in there. I said, hey, man, how you doing? What's up? He looked at me like, you son of a, you was a nigga all along. You.
Hold on, you were talking right there.
He was mad. He looked at me. He was like, okay, you know we don't get you. You know, I thought you was. I said, okay. So that's what y'all been doing. And I asked him, I said, I need a 12-gauge shotgun. He said, it's not for sale. I said, well, you got the price. He said, I said they ain't for sale. Go someplace else and buy one.
Yeah.
I said, all right, man. Thank you, man. He said, man, get out of here. Get out. So what they're doing is respecting and giving and benefiting everybody but you.
But us.
Now, what we got to do now is look for the solution. So sit back a minute, brother, because the switchboard lighting up. I got to open up these doors. We're dealing with the solution tonight. We're going to get to the solution, okay?
Okay, I got you. All right.
Get along. Eric Cole, 215. Tell me who you are, where you calling from. Question or comment. Come on in, man.
What's going on?
Hey, I'm fine, brother. Let me have it.
Yeah, see, the Chinese, man, doing that thing. We had all them banned stores on the corners, man. We ain't do nothing with them damn stores, man, you know. And it's a shame all these years, man, they've been sitting there just rotting. You know, then the Koreans come over.
You know, what do you suggest we do with them?
You know what I'm saying? And so, it starts from family. Family start taking off, man, when those drugs came in our area, man, brother. And nobody was sitting out eating dinner together like we did back in the old days. We all sat together and got in everybody's business. What's happening today? How you doing? What grade you in? You know what I'm saying? At the table. You know what I mean? Ain't going to be none of that. Oh, well, I'm going to eat downstairs. No, you eat up in the front room like everybody else. You know?
Okay.
No, I'm going upstairs. I'm third floor. I'm going to eat my food up there. Nah. We all sit together and we're going to circle this thing and find out everybody's business or problems. And the family would deal with that. You know, all that's gone. That's been gone, man. And these drugs, they're coming in, messing the families up. He gets high, leave a mother. She's stranded with the children, raising a woman, raising two boys or whatever. You know what I'm saying? What she know?
Well, let me ask you
this.
Let me ask you this. In your opinion,
what do you think the solution is? But the problem was how it all started. You know.
Well, let me ask you this: what is the solution in your opinion?
And you got the solution. You're telling it now. Okay, I was just cutting in on back why this thing happened. The big picture is, why did this happen? How did this happen? Did we forget? We got hit in the head or something? You know, for real, all storefront, North Philly, South Philly, West Philly, you know what I'm saying? All these stores are abandoned, man, just rotten. Who comes in?
All right, well, hold on a minute, because we're going to get to the solution. Let me open up the next line, and we're going to get to the solution tonight. Area code 512. Tell me who you are, where you calling from, what you pushing the comment. 512. Come on in. 512.
Hello? Hello?
Hey, man. Come on.
Hey, how you doing? Okay, this is this is Eliyahu out of Austin. Okay, I had actually three questions.
Okay, and it's about what we're discussing here tonight, right?
Well, I mean, I called you earlier about a question that I had pertaining the.
Let me ask you this. The question that you have are the questions about what we are discussing here tonight.
Right. Yes. Yes, they are. Okay. Great. The first is about the mortgage, and we're trying to discharge a mortgage on a home right now.
Wait a minute, but brother, we're not talking about the mortgage. The title of the conversation tonight is the coming African American Holy Cost, and what's going on with us inside this country. I might have not announced that to you, but I tell you what, hold on, and what you do is contact me in the morning, and we will deal with them questions. How about that?
Okay. So what time is a great time? Better time to give you a call in the morning.
Call me after 8 a.m. in the morning.
After 8 a.m. Okay. Is that a Central or Eastern?
Okay then, brother. All right, Moses. If you got any questions about what we are discussing here this evening, go ahead, raise your hand. I'll open up the lines so we can get on with it. Because now this is my observation. This is my conclusion. What has transpired is the fact that we have violated some principles. The principles is we have failed to realize that the brain has never been removed from the skull. The skull that contains the brain has never been removed from the shoulders. We got the same brain that we was using in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. So what we're talking about now is the changing of a mind. If we have allowed some other person or some other entity to put information in the brain to the point that we think that we're under control. It could have been from drugs. It could have been from heroin. It could have been from television. It could have been from radio. We have to ask ourselves, do we own and control these entities? The manufacturing, the distribution, the networks, the advertisement. If we don't, we have allowed something else to occupy the brain. However, if at any given point in time that we decide to stop and say, this is inside my skull, this skull that houses brain is attached to my shoulders, I'm going to take control of it because I don't know no other reason in the world why the Creator would attach it to me. Why, if it was meant to be controlled by somebody else, why did he not give it to NBC? or ABC or the NFL or the or the NBA. Why is it that he gave it to me and brought all the animals to me to see what I would call them, gave me dominion of the earth, and then I turn around and gave something and somebody else control of this brain to the point where my whole nation has ended up in shambles? The brother just said that he got family members who want to go in the basement. Other family members, he want to go upstairs and eat his dinner. But everybody is afraid to get together and come together as a single unit inside of an enclosed environment, and all of the people in the environment have a brain attached to their own shoulders. This is amazing. What happened? Because just yesterday, we were walking down the street to myself, and oh, I'm black and I'm proud. The sisters was wearing their own hair. You don't have to take my word for it. Just go back and look and watch the videos right there on YouTube. They were beautiful. I see some beautiful sisters. Woo! They had on their little blouses. They had on their little outfits. They little dashikas, they pants, they skirts, they dresses. They was beautiful. But the most beautiful thing in the world to me, and it's just my preference, don't get mad at me, they had their own hair. Woo, Lord. You get passionate and want to rub your hand through something, don't nothing fall off on the floor. Everything is right there intact. But today, I look around and I see all these beautiful black sisters with straight hair. And they're talking about, child, I got to go get a perm. For what? What are you going to do? Put some chemicals in your hair, let it seep down into the pores of your brain? And then convince yourself that you are attracted when you attractive when you look like somebody else from another culture? What's wrong with you? What were you born with? I don't understand. I don't know why. What is going wrong? At all of them, I can walk into a place and cut on the video on YouTube and go from one to the other. And a lot of them say, well, I got my degree at so-and-so and so-and-so, but your hair is straight. It, to me, and please don't fault me, this is just me. This is just how I see it, based on the study and research that I have and the knowledge I have of my own self, of my own culture, and the illustrations that I've seen of my own people from my own ancient story. I have yet to see anything back in them ancient stories and cultures of anything that I'm seeing today that's considering themselves beautiful. It seems to me as though the total brain is being occupied by something or someone else from another nation or another planet. This is what I'm seeing. And it's just totally amazing for it to be standing across the board, totally acceptable, and someone parades somebody out in front of you to meet, and you are looking at this thing, and the first thing you do is you look at the head, and you see a sister with hair fashioned like a Caucasian or an Asian, a straight hair. But when I go and look at the illustrations in the books and paintings of the ancient Africans, or the ancient people of African descent inside the United States, it's not seen. It's amazing how this phenomenon has taken place. And if you don't believe me, go on the news tonight. Now, you have my permission to watch TV for 5 minutes. Cut on the news. The only reason you're cutting on the news is because you're looking at the sisters that are on the news and you're looking at their hair. And that way you can see what I'm talking about. It is amazing to me. It's like this is the way that it's supposed to be, regardless of the fact that I already have a culture and it never existed this way. Amazing. But anyway, I just wanted to point that part out. We're going to move forward now.
It is a story everyone knows. After a rude refusal by a local innkeeper, Mary and Joseph bedded down in a barn in Bethlehem. The next day, Mary gave birth to a son, the Son of God. Those are the biblical origins of Christmas. But centuries before Jesus walked the earth, early Europeans were celebrating light and birth in the darkest days of winter. In the Norse country, this winter celebration was known as Yule. Around December 21st, the winter solstice, fathers and sons would drag home the biggest log they could find and set it on fire. The Yule log warmed, but it also looked ahead. Each spark was said to represent a pig or calf to be born in the spring. Also dragged inside were evergreens, the one plant that could make it through a Norse winter. Evergreens proved that life persisted in this dark time.
There's a natural attraction to that which lives through the winter, when one is struggling to survive through the winter. The evergreen is that part of nature that seems impervious to the coming of winter and the diminishing of the sun. And so it's an absolutely natural symbol, one which I think you react to almost without thinking about.
For as long as the Yule log burned, about 12 days, feasting and revelry reigned supreme. In fact, this was one of the few times that meat was abundant, since cattle had just been slaughtered for the long winter.
There is a necessity to kill most of the cattle, because you can't keep them alive over the winter when there's nothing to feed them on. You keep a few alive for breeding. But there is an opportunity for a great blowout, for a great feast, time to party.
The party raged inside in defiance of winter's deadly howl.
There is a spooky feel about the northern Yuletide festivals. You may be all right there in the hall with the blazing fires, but outside there are demons, there are spirits.
In Germany, the pagan god Odin lent his name to this midwinter holiday. Early Germans were terrified of Odin, whose nocturnal flights decided who would prosper or perish in the coming year. Later, we'd see another Christmas sky rider, Santa Claus. But for now, staying inside became the smartest choice at this frightening time of the year. A thousand miles away in Rome, winter was less harrowing, but the December festivals were just as elaborate. 1 week before the winter solstice, Romans began celebrating Saturnalia, a month-long orgy of food and drink. Named for the god Saturn, which meant plenty, Rome's established order was turned on its head during this wild, delirious time.
The Saturnalia celebrations were certainly times of revelry, of turning the social order upside down, of having the master pretend to be the slave and the slave pretend to be the master, sort of a time out of time in which one could celebrate a kind of disorder in the universe.
One of the holiday's important feasts was Juvenalia, which celebrated the children of Rome.
Although these early festivals are not necessarily about children particularly, though they are about fertility, children did have their particular place. The indulgence of children, of course, is very much a part of our modern Christmas, but it did have its place even in these ribald, drunken festivals that the Romans had.
Among the upper classes in Rome, solstice celebrations were significantly more sober. Many influential Romans worshipped Mithra, the god of the unconquerable sun. To this small but powerful sect, the birthday of Mithra was the holiest day of the year.
December 25th was the winter solstice in that part of the world, and it was also understood to be the birthday of the sun god, Mithra. And Mithra was said to be born from a rock. Shepherds came to worship him as he was an infant god born out in that pastoral place in the fields. And many of those stories, of course, have come into Christian tradition.
While Romans were worshiping the sun god, a new religion was taking hold throughout the empire. At first, Christians didn't celebrate the birth of Christ. His resurrection was the essential fact of the new religion. By the 4th century, however, the question of the holy birth became impossible to ignore.
There were questions within the church about how do we even imagine Jesus? Some people believe that Jesus was purely a spiritual emanation of God, and others believe that Jesus must have actually appeared on earth, and so the decision to celebrate Jesus' birth meant that Jesus was actually a human or a human form.
For Christians, the fact of his birth was settled, but the date remained a mystery. The Bible doesn't mention exactly when Christ was born, but certain facts suggest it probably was not in December.
If you're going to sort through the runes of the scriptures, Jesus was probably born in the spring. If the shepherds are out in the fields watching their flock by night, we're not talking about one of the cold spells at the heart of winter.
If pagan Rome was already celebrating the birth of Mithra on December 25th, it seemed natural to honor the birth of the Christ child at the same time. By the 4th century, the church made it official. December 25th was declared the feast day of the Nativity.
But of course, it's a very short step from the feast day of the risen sun, S-U-N, to the feast day of the risen sun, S-O-N. So in a sense, it's a very good choice that the symbolism is there, because the feast day of the unconquered sun was about fertility, about birth, and so obviously is the Christian Christmas.
The church knew it could not outlaw the pagan traditions of Christmas, so it set out to adopt them. The evergreens traditionally brought inside were soon decorated with apples, symbolizing the Garden of Eden. These apples would eventually become Christmas ornaments. And holly, a traditional midwinter decoration, was recast to represent Christ's crown of thorns.
People already had their own agenda for this season, and that agenda was not one that was really radically changed when the names got changed from non-Christian to Christian names. The church pretty much had a policy of live and let live. If people would call themselves Christians and do lip service to the birth of the Savior, then let them do anything that they wanted to do with it. But on the other hand, by assigning the nativity to that time of year, the church really gave up the opportunity to control the way that celebration took place.
The tension between piety and revelry at Christmas would reach its logical and extreme conclusion in Puritan England, when the holiday would be considered so unchristian it was done away with altogether.
Okay, we're back. Now, before we go back to some more of that, I don't want the sisters to think that I've been picking on them, because back in the day, the sisters would follow us. Whatever we did, they was bagging us up. And I think that some kind of way, I don't know where it came from, I ain't got to the bottom of this, but the brothers came out with the what it was, the conk. And I remember in the early 60s, I had an uncle. And my uncle had a perfect process. I mean, it was perfect. His process was so perfect, which was amazing to me, because he had a black scarf. And the only time he would take the black scarf off that I knew of, because I ain't know nothing about sex. No, that was taboo. The only time I see him take the scarf off is when I was standing in the door and watch him stand in front of the mirror. He'll take the scarf off and pat and check his due. And then he would take the scarf and put it back on and wrap it back up, and then go outside and walk through the neighborhood with the scarf covering up the process. I couldn't understand why, okay, if this is supposed to be it, this is supposed to be something, it's odd, I don't understand it, because my Uncle LJ, my Uncle Boo, my Uncle James, and all the other men, they ain't got nothing like that. But then you go overseas, go in the military, when you come out the military, you got this hair do, and my mama trying to keep up with you with a hair do. So I don't understand that. And so then he eventually left. So I forgot about the hair do. Then the Beatles came out, and with the hair thing, and they were shaking their hair and all that right there, and then it seemed like more brothers in the neighborhood came out with the process thing. And but I wouldn't, you know, I was just a kid. I was like first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade and all this. You know, I had a very fertile mind. I was watching this thing unfold. This was a phenomenon. I didn't know what it was, but I was just looking at it. But then I started noticing that people start, the hair that I was used to seeing start changing. The men, they had these scarves on their head, and they had the tie thing in the front where they were tied up with the black scarf, and they would go through the neighborhood, and this was it. But I did not know what that meant. All I knew is was like they was doing things that the only person I seen do it was my mama, because they was patting the hair and all of this stuff. And to me, a man, he ain't never patted nothing, but a woman, but they was patting the head. So this was odd to me. But nevertheless, I thought it was just, well, okay, this is just life. This is what we supposed to do. And so I just kept on going. I see more and more men with the do thing. But then the 60s hit. I see less and less dudes. I see what was called a natural. Okay, so that meant to me that somebody had to stop this phenomenon that was going on, and everybody was wearing their own hair. And then the brothers was wearing the African bush. And then the sisters ain't about to be outdone. They was wearing African bushes that was out of this world. The brothers, they lost the African bush contest, in my opinion. Now, you had some brothers that was busting. They had some, because I had a brother, the brother next to me, Junior had a natural bush. The boy bush was so bad, it was out of this world. Now, me and my other brother, we couldn't grow now. I had a mini bush, but nobody ain't say nothing to me about having no bush because I have muscles in my eyelashes, so I ain't need no bush. All I had to do is just walk past you. You just faint. But anyway, we were rolling. But the sisters that we went to school with, they could grow a bush. To me, it seemed like if we went home on Friday from school, when Monday came back, they had a bush. And then we had this thing where the brothers was coming out with straightening combs. They'll take a straightening comb and run a straightening comb through the hair, and they had more hair on Monday than they had on Friday. And they were standing up, and I couldn't figure that out until somebody told me what was going on. I said, how you got all the hair? They said, man, you're using a straightening comb on the hair. I said, straightening comb? I said, you put the straightening comb put a straightening comb in his hair? He said, yeah. He said, all you got to do is look at his forehead and see burn himself right there. See that little burn spot? I said, okay. So, my brother bush was so bad, I had to get me a bush. But so in order to get one, I had to use straightening comb. But then when they run that straightening comb through my head and burn me one time, I said, okay, that's it. Well, you got a straight over here, and so I said, I don't care what I got. If you don't heat up nothing else, I said, that was the end of that. End of that for me. I ain't worried about nothing else no more. But then we went on through the 60s with that. And then the next thing you know, going in the 70s, and the bush is still rolling, the bush is some kind of way that the African bush, the African culture, and the dashiki, and the Nehru's, and the little bone suits, and Johnny Taylor, he was busting with that, and seeing it died out. But then we got down into the 80s, and the tail end of the 70s, and going into the 80s, they came out with the Jerry Curl. Oh, man. Woo! Man, the Jerry Curl. Jerry Curl bust up the world because we had brothers who never had a girlfriend in their life. They was ugly. All of a sudden, had a Jerry Curl, but the Jerry Curl changed their personality and their attitude and outlook on life. They didn't have no women, but they had Jerry Curl, and then they had a Cadillac or a Lincoln. So they had all girls and plenty of money. But they had the Jerry Curl, and the Jerry Curl graduated into what I found out later was called the California Curls. I said, okay, I got to go get me one of them. But I had a cousin uptown. Now, my cousin uptown, he had a Cookerville Cadillac. He didn't wear no Jerry Curl. He didn't wear no California Curl. He had a perm, like a woman. And I said, well, what you got? What's in your hair? He said, this is a perm. He said, I got a girl to do my hair. He said, I pay her, take care of her. I said, okay. And he had the perm. And I asked him, how did he get the perm? And he said, well, you had to do this. Had to get, you know, they take the straightening comb out. When he missed the straightening comb, I said, oh, no. I ain't going to get that one. So I ain't getting that one. But then the California curl, I found out what it was doing. It was growing the hair. So I had all this hair on my head. Until I discovered for my own self that my hair was longer than my woman's hair. And I knew at that point that something was wrong. So I went to the barbershop and I got a haircut. We got normal. But I didn't know nothing about how to tell her to which way to go. I didn't know to tell her that she needed to start going and growing her own hair. So we were just stuck in this paradigm for all these years until we start examining the photographs of our ancient culture and stuff, and I did not understand that I had loaned my brain to somebody else, and all of us have. We have allowed somebody else to set us up and put us in a position to be a permanent underclass and be subservient to everybody except us. And it's a phenomenon because we're the greatest and most powerful people on the planet. Father.
By the Middle Ages, Christianity had largely replaced the old pagan religions of Europe. On December 25th, the faithful were called to Gothic cathedrals like Notre Dame and Salisbury Cathedral in England for Christ's Mass, soon to be called Christmas. But out in the streets, the holiday was still more raucous than religious.
If you went to England around Christmas time, any time before, say, 1800, you'd probably feel pretty ill at ease. You wouldn't think it was Christmas at all. What would you think it was? Maybe Mardi Gras? Maybe New Year's Eve? Maybe Halloween? Because Christmas in old-time England was really a carnival.
The houses of London were littered with brawling, drunken villagers and couples engaged in the most unholy activities. And each Christmas, a beggar or student was temporarily put in charge after being crowned the Lord of Misrule. The rest of the peasantry also got their once-a-year chance to grab power from the ruling classes.
They would go around to the houses of the rich, or they would bang on the doors and demand entry, and once they were let in, the lord of the manor had to give them the best stuff that he had. He had to give them his best food, he had to give them his best beer, his best of everything.
And a jolly one day, it's then you shall be.
But if he didn't, they would threaten or actually perform a trick.
Come butler, come fiddler.
One surviving Christmas song says, if you don't give us what we want, then down will come butler, bowl and all.
But if you do cross the bowl of the small, then down shall go butler, bowl and all.
Some historians think that it performed the role of a safety valve. You might say that a wealthy man could make up for an entire year of small or large injustices to the poor by giving a generous Christmas handout just once in the year.
The rules of Christmas would soon change, however, as a wave of religious reform swept through England in the early 17th century. Led by Oliver Cromwell, the Puritans overthrew the king's forces in 1645 and vowed to rid England of all that was decadent. High on their list was English Christmas, and in 1652 they outlawed it altogether. Shops were ordered to stay open. Churches were forced to stay closed.
The Puritans were always, I think, deeply attracted to those things that they were most opposed to. They had a fear that they might have too good of a time. I don't mean to trivialize them, but there was a deep fear that if these things were legalized, they themselves might enjoy them and their souls would be lost.
The Puritans may have said good riddance to Christmas, but the people never really stopped celebrating it. The holiday merely went underground. If Christmas pie was illegal, it began to be known as mince pie instead, which was just as delicious.
The deeper need for Christmas in the human heart, the need for celebration at a time of darkness, those needs made the battle against Christmas, gave it a few temporary wins, but it couldn't possibly secure a final victory.
In 1656, the men of Kent and Canterbury passed a resolution saying that if they could not have their Christmas day, they would have the king back on his throne. They soon got their wish. The monarchy was restored with Charles II, and Christmas was restored with him. It seemed the English could live without a king, but not without Christmas.
It has been argued that one reason for the restoration of the monarchy is because by restoring the monarchy, you also restored Christmas, or restored the proper English Christmas with its rituals, its traditions, and its carousing. Christmas is brought back, if you like, by popular acclaim.
The fight against Christmas may have been lost in England, but the Puritans had high hopes for the new colonies in America. In 1620, a small group of separatists came ashore at Plymouth, Massachusetts. Even more orthodox than their English cousins, these men and women hoped to rid themselves once and for all of the Christmas scourge. In 1659, Puritans in Boston followed their English brethren in outlawing Christmas. Anyone caught exhibiting the Christmas spirit was fined 5 shillings. Like in England, however, Christmas remained impossible to contain. The 1719 Boston Almanac doesn't list a Christmas holiday, but it does recommend that in late December you not let your children and servants run too much abroad at night.
From almost the beginning in Massachusetts, there's evidence that some people practiced Christmas, and that when they did so, it was in fact an opportunity to get drunk. And one of the most interesting little sidelights on this is the finding of historical demographers that there was actually a bulge in conceptions, the conception of children, that took place during Christmas.
Not all the colonies had such trouble with Christmas. Captain John Smith, leader of the Jamestown settlement in Virginia, wrote that their first New World Christmas was kept with plenty of good oysters, wild fowl, and good bread. Jamestown settlers were also the first to drink eggnog as a Christmas drink, the nog coming from the word grog, which means any drink made with rum. After independence, however, all things English fell out of favor in America, Christmas included. In fact, on December 25, 1789, the United States Congress sat in session and continued to stay open on Christmas Day for most of the next 67 years.
At the same time, there are people who are writing in their diaries that, isn't it too bad we don't have any holidays? So after the Revolution, here is an entire nation that works hard, has forsaken many holidays, has given up many holidays because they were holidays that were mandated by the crown, and it is time to start thinking about how to populate the calendar.
As the 19th century dawned, Christmas would be one holiday that would pull the new nation together. But it wouldn't be the carnival Christmas of old England, nor would it be particularly religious. America would invent its very own Christmas, and in the process, reinvent it for the whole world.
Okay, we're back, Moles. What is interesting to me up until this point is the fact that I'm waiting on them to mention where or what or when or why what counterweight on the side, in the middle, or on the left, whatever, does this particular custom, a holiday, have to do with people of African descent? And the reason why is because I'm watching a phenomenon. I'm going to be out there on December the 23rd, 24th, and 25th, and 22nd to see the overall conditions of the brain of my people. That will tell me several things. That will tell me that they're still under the spell of allowing somebody else to either rent, or lease, or hold their brain instead of them taking total control and responsibility of it, even though it's inside their skull, and their skull is attached to their shoulders, if you can understand what I'm saying to you. Because I know for a fact that if you take control of your own thinking, start doing an investigation of it, you will eventually grow into being able to be happy and proud about your own self and about your own culture, even though you will discover that you will be alone because there's nobody in your circle that will ever question you about what you believe. They will automatically assume that your brain is out to lunch. How you doing? What's going on? Merry Christmas. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Easter. Happy New Year. Even though New Year's, how can you call something a New Year in the dead of winter? When all the trees are dead, all the animals on the ground, there's no life, no people dying in the snow, getting hit by cars, all kind of stuff. But then when spring comes and all things come to light, it seems to me common sense tells me that that should be labeled as the New Year. But we can't do that. We have to label that something else. We cannot allow you to realize and wake up to the fact and start. We can't let you start there by calling this New Year's and walk around and say Happy New Year in the middle of spring and acknowledge the fact that God is the God of the living and not the dead. And he's the God of things that come to life and not dead. We've got to maintain the farce, because if we don't maintain the farce and you mess around and wake up, we're doomed. Because you will be free. We can't allow that. We're going to choke you and strangle you until you are dead. And we're going to do it by leasing your brain. We're going to do everything we can to keep you from changing your mind simply by examining the facts and acknowledging the truth for your own self. We got to keep you from doing it. Okay, now, we're going to come back to that, the Christmas thing, because we're looking for where on the planet and on what book and from where ever at any given point in time that we created it. If it have anything to do with us, any kind of way, in any given point in time.
So Tavis Smiley decides to go on the No Spin Zone, and he's going to make two great points here that I absolutely love. The only thing I love more is at the very end, Bill O'Reilly's reaction, so let's all pay close attention.
African Americans are not seeing that same kind of empathy and appreciation for the humanity of Trayvon that they saw for the children of Sandy Hook. I'm waiting to hear, I haven't heard it yet, I'm waiting to hear the NRA say that if Trayvon Martin had had a gun, he might still be alive today. The bottom line is that race is still the most intractable issue in this country, and when an adult can profile and stalk and kill a child in America, our democracy is threatened.
You said that America has
it is
contempt for black
absolutely
men. And they
absolutely
don't. America doesn't have contempt. That's wrong.
That's not true. I'll back it up right now. I've said already that black men so often are viewed in this country as a menace to society, number one. Number two, look at the criminalization, the over-criminalization of black boys in our education system, number two. Number three, look at the racist drug laws. You got to get caught with more crack than powder cocaine to get the same sentence. Look at the high unemployment numbers in this country with specific regard to African-American men. And finally, consider this, Bill. The only reason why this case even was brought in the first place, the only reason why they ever came to trial is because there was a national hue and cry. If there were the value for black male life in America that there is for white male life in America, it wouldn't have required all that it took just to get this even, the charges even filed, the case even brought,
look,
Bill.
I'm glad the case came to trial. I think the trial was fair, and all the points you raise are societal problems where there is another side. There's genocide going on in Chicago, and it's blacks killing blacks, okay? Whites have nothing to do with it. I don't believe that America has contempt for black men. I believe a lot of the problem is generated by the blacks themselves that won't solve the problems of their neighborhood.
I could solve the problem too. Arm every black person in America, and then let's see what the NRA has to say.
All right, Davis. I mean, that's a little extreme.
Oh, I love that. I mean, wait. We argue that all white people should be armed all the time. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, right? That's the only thing that stops it. Arm everybody so they can protect themselves. Oh, wait. We didn't mean black people. I mean, that's a little extreme. No, hey, don't be crazy.
All right. Now we got to do this one more time. We got to do it one more time.
So Tavis Smiley decides to go on the No Spin Zone. And he's going to make two great points here that I absolutely love. The only thing I love more is at the very end, Bill O'Reilly's reaction. So let's all pay close attention.
African Americans are not seeing that same kind of empathy and appreciation for the humanity of Trayvon that they saw for the children of Sandy Hook. I'm waiting to hear, I haven't heard it yet, I'm waiting to hear the NRA say that if Trayvon Martin had a gun, he might still be alive today. The bottom line is that race is still the most intractable issue in this country. And when an adult can profile and stalk and kill a child in America, our democracy is threatened.
You said that America has
it is
contempt for black
absolutely
men. And they
absolutely
don't. America doesn't have contempt. That's wrong.
That's not true. I'll back it up right now. I've said already that black men so often are viewed in this country as a menace to society, number one. Number two, look at the criminalization, the over-criminalization of black boys in our education system, number two. Number three, look at the racist drug laws. You got to get caught with more crack than powder cocaine to get the same sentence. Look at the high unemployment numbers in this country with specific regard to African-American men. And finally, consider this, Bill. The only reason why this case even was brought in the first place, the only reason why they ever came to trial is because there was a national hue and cry. If there were the value for black male life in America that there is for white male life in America, it wouldn't have required all that it took just to get this even, the charges even filed, the case even brought,
look,
Bill.
I'm glad the case came to trial. I think the trial was fair, and all the points you raise are societal problems where there is another side. There's genocide going on in Chicago, and it's blacks killing blacks, okay? Whites have nothing to do with it. I don't believe that America has contempt for black men. I believe a lot of the problem is generated by the blacks themselves that won't solve the problems of their neighborhood.
I could solve the problem too. Arm every black person in America, and then let's see what the NRA has to say.
All right, Davis. I mean, that's a little extreme.
Oh, I love that. I mean, wait. We argue that all white people should be armed all the time. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, right? That's the only thing that stops it. Arm everybody so they can protect themselves. Oh, wait. We didn't mean black people. I mean, that's a little extreme. No, hey, don't be crazy, dog, okay? I mean, I didn't mean black men. That's crazy talk. You know how they are. Thank you very much for proving Tavis Smiley's point perfectly, right? Now, Smiley also mentioned in there, he said, all right, I was like, hey, you can't prove it. It reminded me, of course, tides go in, tides go out. You can't explain that. And he's like, well, actually, I can. Let me give you a four-part thesis on it. One thing he didn't even mention is blacks and whites in this country use drugs at the same exact rate, you know, per capita, as a percentage of the population, et cetera, right? But blacks get arrested at four times the rate. So that was done in a recent study in some cities and some states at eight times the rate of whites. No, you can't say that Americans treat blacks in any way differently. No, of course not. No, I mean, I wouldn't give them guns or anything like that. Look at the genocide they're committing in Chicago. All of a sudden, it's a genocide. Look, we talk about Chicago on the show all the time. But to say that, to turn that around, like, there's no, black people don't have any problem with whites in this country. They don't have any problem with injustice in this country. The only problem black people have is, according to O'Reilly, you heard it right there in that clip, other black people. You have the same problem as white people do, black people. He said, oh, no, blacks are doing it to themselves. They're doing the genocide. And then I love the earlier point Smiley made as well. Hey, how come the NRA hasn't come out and said, if Trayvon just had a gun, he'd be alive today? Isn't that what they say in almost every instance? The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun who comes and picks a fight with you and follows you around the neighborhood and stalks you is a good guy with a gun. If Trayvon had had the gun, we wouldn't have had this tragedy in the first place. Wow, that's really weird. The NRA didn't say that. It seemed like all the gun advocates seemed to be on Zimmerman's side, even though he's the one that seemed to have started the altercation, certainly followed Trayvon, and he's the one that killed Trayvon. Now, if you have a gun and you're using it against a black guy, you are by definition innocent. But I don't know what Tavis Smiley would be talking about. Discrimination against blacks in this country? Oh, no. Only by other blacks. That's O'Reilly's theory.
Oh, man, this is amazing. Okay, now, at this point, I would like to ask if anybody can dissect that. Go ahead and raise your hand. I'll open up the line, and you can dissect that. That's quite interesting because I know for a fact, I look back at when we were growing up, we had our little bookers and stuff like that, but when we had a situation, when everybody was armed, and everybody, whether they was armed or not, was manning up, there was peace in the valley. But if you got a situation where people are armed, and then you have the other people that's been disarmed by the brain, then it seems to be a situation where the people who are armed physically always overrule the people who are disarmed by the brain. They've loaned their brain out. They have leased it out. They have done no research about themselves. They are filled with fear because they have not replaced fear with skill. Then we have a problem. It's amazing how that works. And I keep bringing up the same equation because of the men that I knew. These men here, they would come in and they would not raise their voice. They would say certain things, and the house would move. Everything would move. There was no, I didn't see any kind of thing resembling any kind of rebellion. No kind of I have opinion about this. I think we need to do something. It was non-existent. But today, I witness chaos all the way down the street. I can see it all the way down the street. I have witnesses from two blocks away between men and women. And so that tells me that something is wrong inside where? The brain. So if I'm going to deal with a situation, the first place that I have to deal with, I have to start with the brain. Area code 504. Tell me who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question about this topic tonight?
Islam, this Brother Cepha Collins. How you doing?
Hey, man. What you think about it?
I was listening to that thing about Trayvon, and I saw this something on YouTube yesterday about his father being a Mason and everything. And, they never had said nothing about that on the news, you know, and it looked like, you know, it could have been that Zimmerman was a high killer, you know. Did you hear anything about that?
I have I heard something about that, about his father being a Mason and all the rest stuff like that. You know, I've heard about it, but that don't mean nothing to me. I don't know nothing. I mean, I know about it, but it does not faze me the fact that he's a Mason.
Right.
His family's amazing, all of that there. The way I see it is, I can only go on what's in me, or what I came up with, you know, who did it, where he at. And then there's silence. But I don't know anything about him being amazing. It's supposed to be something special. I don't know nothing about that.
Okay, they got on left something on YouTube about it.
It's all over everywhere, but I don't entertain that, you know.
Right.
I don't look at none of that. That don't make no decision about nothing.
Right. I just thought it was worth bringing up since, you know, this man talked about.
Yeah. Well, brother, I certainly appreciate you calling in. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Appreciate it.
Well, anyway, we're going to roll forward, move. We had, what I used to see, and the reason why I say the things that say is because of what I seen. And this is what I seen and what I know. I have seen men. And these men, it didn't matter whether you had on a gun, a badge, or you were an FBI agent, or whatever, it wasn't nothing to do with none of that, with a man. So that's all I have to, that's all I know, that's all I ever seen. That's the foundation of what all men of African descent in America need to have. Because that's just all I know. I don't understand that because you somebody have told you that you were this, that, and the other, that's supposed to win a fight for you. And you don't have to take my word for it. Just go on YouTube and type in story of Jack Johnson. Now, Jack Johnson, he came about at a point in time in history inside these United States. And I use the word history because he came in doing someone else's rendition of someone else's writing their story. And it's just that. Hill's story. But Jack Johnson came in and he had beat physically man to man, toe to toe, wasn't no shooting, wasn't no knives, nothing. You know, we manning up. Everybody in his class, wasn't nobody else to beat. But the sport was controlled, operated by Caucasians that had got it from you know where. But anyway, they were declaring themselves heavyweight champion of the world, and Jack Johnson, he stepped to the heavyweight champion of the world and said, well, look, I would like to have a chance. And the media jumped in there. Well, he's yellow. He's a coward. And, he's challenging the heavyweight champion of the world. He ain't got no business doing that. That's total disrespect and all that. And Jack said, well, look, maybe so. Maybe you say I'm yellow, but I said, would you please give me a shot at the title? And I'm not going to give you no shot at the title. You can't whoop me. And so. And he said, I understand all that, but would you give me a shot at the title? And, no, you. So Jack Johnson had to follow this man all over America. And eventually the man went to Australia. Jack Johnson went to Australia, followed him there. He had the money to do it. Followed him there and trying to get a fight. He was dishing him over there. And finally come back to America and he cornered him in a bar. Walked straight up in the bar and said, look, I need a fight, me and you, man to man. And he told him, said, well, look, I'll fight you. But we got to fight in the basement. It's just going to be me and you, man to man, Jack Johnson. No, I need the world to see this. I need the world to see it. Well, I'm not going to give you no fighting and stuff. And so finally, Jack Johnson cornered him again. And then this time he said, well, you got to have X amount of dollars. I think it was, and don't quote me on that, I think it was $12,000 or $20,000 or something. $25,000 or something. But a Jew heard him and had been following him watching the man-to-man challenge. You say, don't worry about it. I'll put up the money for the fight. You got to worry about it. So what you going to do now? It's on. They had the fight scheduled. The whole world came out to see the fight. Folks saw. You know, we was not allowed to come out there. They got in the ring. The heavyweight champion was a favorite. Just because everybody hated back Jack Johnson. The media was calling them cowards and yellow and the blackies and everything they could to drag him down, but that ain't going to do no good. That ain't going to do no good because I need to stand in front of this man. So when they got in the ring, it was on. He did the best he could, but he couldn't stop Jack. Jack was hitting him with actually wasn't hitting him with everything he got, but he was picking him to pieces, blood spattered and everywhere. And the crowd began to roar, stop him. Don't let him out. Don't let him knock him out. Stop the fight. Don't let him knock him out. It got so bad that he couldn't see. You know, close his eyes. Whole chest full of blood. And to the point where when he was almost about to hit him and kill him up in there, man to man, the police jumped in the ring with guns in their hand. Stop. Don't hit him no more. It's over. Don't you hear him no more. Couldn't come out for the bell no more. Jack Johnson became the heavyweight champion of the world, man to man. They had to stop him. Didn't need no weapon. All he had was what he was born with. He ran and he ran and he ran. He called him all kind of names. But he couldn't stop this man to man. Couldn't stop it. Finally, he had to face it. But when he did, because they had held whoever was the winner and the heavyweight champion of the world was the real man in America. After that fight, violence erupted all across the United States. People of African descent was jubilant. They were celebrating. They was having parties. They were dancing in the street. They were being kidnapped, they were being lynched and murdered and killed for an honest man-to-man, toe-to-toe bout against the so-called heavyweight champion of the world. The same type of thing goes on today. But what has happened now, we have nuclear weapons, we have the FBI, we have the CIA, we have Homeland Security, we have everything. We have prisons, concentration camps that we're calling prisons, and we're doing everything we can to put you in there. Never again will we be forced to have to face you with what God gave you. We're going to keep the advantage of you. We got automatic weapons. We even got tanks in certain cities. These people hounded Jack Johnson all the way across the United States. But one thing that I respected about the man is he did whatever he wanted to do because he was free, because he had no fear abiding in him. He replaced fear with skill. He went through Georgia, blew past a police officer. Police pulled him over and said, "Do you know what you're doing?" He said, "You speak." He said, "I'm going to have to give you a fine." He said, "How much is a fine?" He said, "I'm going to have to charge you $50. Jack Johnson reached in his pocket and gave him a $100 bill. He said, "I ain't got change for that." He said, "Keep the change because I'm coming back the same way that I came through." Now, what has transpired today is the brain has been loaned or leased or rented by something else that is diffusing the brain, which carries the natural talents that you were born with. So now we have fear that should be replaced by skill. And we are in a very dangerous situation. So when someone comes to me about some off-the-wall stuff about something, I don't know nothing about that. Ain't nobody done nothing to me. Therefore, there's no need for anything else. We are supposed to live in peace. But you live better in peace when you have knowledge of self. After all, the brain is attached to your shoulders. So therefore, you should be able to have what's supposed to go in it. The same thing that every other nation on the face of the earth have in theirs, knowledge of self. You mentioned pride that the Chinese and the Koreans and the Japanese and the Mexicans and all they have, well, they have knowledge of self. They get knowledge of self, too. Go back and study the greatness and magnificence of your story. Go do the whole story of Jack Johnson. Go do the whole story of Muhammad Ali. Go do the whole story of all the great people that you know that look like you. After you do that, then you can go and examine the stories and great stories of somebody else that don't look like you. But you got to start with you first. You have to start with you. And that way you ain't got to get upset. Somebody wrong you, you got the skills, you're equipped, you know what to do. There was another man who got in the ring. Jack said, "Well, I'm a little Caucasian gentleman," and say, "Well, Jack, can we go in there and do some sparring?" Jack said, we can make it an exhibition. And because I ain't got nobody else to fight, nobody more else will get in the ring with me. So we can do an exhibition so we can earn some more money because I like to live a nice, free lifestyle and stuff. So they got in the ring and did a little sparring. But what the little Caucasian dude tried to do is they throw a punch and try to knock Jack out on the slide. So so it could be caught by the camera and he could be held as somebody. And he hit Jack, called Jack, hit Jack. Jack fell off. Oh, my goodness, what is this man doing? This supposed to be, we ain't supposed to be trying to hurt, but he ain't no match for me. But Jack said, that's okay. Got up. And then went going. Jack hit him so hard to the cameras recorded Jack taking his hand and wiping this man's teeth out of his gloves. Needless to say, that trick was never played again. Never tried to assassinate Jack. Jack walked in and went wherever he wanted to go. Jack ain't, he had number of Caucasian women. That's all he ever had. And I think Jack was doing that to mess with somebody. I believe, in my personal opinion, that's what I believe. That's all he had. But nobody messed with Jack. Jack was, you know, Jack would come in and he'd stay as long as he wanted, get drink as much as he wanted, leave, go in and go out, stay with him. But nobody didn't mess with Jack. Nobody didn't mess with Jack. But anyway, then it come along the Louisville Slugger. And Muhammad Ali, and then we had before him, Sugar Ray Robinson, and all the rest of all the way, you know, all the way down the line. But so what has been taking place now is a consistent brainwashing system to remove the natural strength and power of something that you were born with. You got to watch out for that thing, man.
New York City, 1820. Within the space of a generation, New York had gone from a backwater port town to the center of American commerce. Great wealth came to a few during these years, and moderate livings to the burgeoning middle class. But the Industrial Revolution had also created a class of the unemployed and unconnected, whose very existence threatened the cozy world of New York's middle rung. This was never more clear than at Christmas time.
Class conflict was emerging with the earliest stages of industrial capitalism. And so what had previously just had an edge of menace, a little bit of trick, but much more goodwill, much more treat, now changed, and the menace became increasingly obvious and increasingly serious. So that by the 1820s, the Christmas season in cities like New York was really a time of gang rioting, a really very, very nasty scene. So nasty, in fact, that in the year 1828, the New York City Council for the first time instituted a professional police force for the city as a direct result of a particularly savage Christmas season riot the year before.
New York's upper class was worried. So worried that a few of them set out to change the way the holiday was celebrated. Washington Irving was America's best-selling novelist. And in 1819, he used his expertise to write Bracebridge Hall, an enormously popular series of stories about Christmas at an imaginary English manor house. Here, the classes mingled effortlessly as squires welcomed friendly and grateful peasants into their homes. And in 1843, England's most popular writer, Charles Dickens, tackled the Christmas problem with A Christmas Carol. It was a bestseller in London and America, and the lessons of the story struck a powerful chord on both sides of the Atlantic.
Christmas Carol, I think, showed the Victorians what could be the use and the meaning of Christmas in a society which was quite pleased with itself in a way, but which nevertheless had fears about inequality, about too much materialism, about perhaps just too rapid change.
There have been countless treatments of this Christmas classic, some in print and some on screen. This television version is from 1958, but the themes are straight out of the 19th century.
You want all day tomorrow, I suppose, Cressid.
Quite convenient, huh?
It's not convenient.
But it's only one day in the year, sir.
A poor excuse to pick the pocket of your employer every 25th of December.
I think the character of Ebenezer Scrooge taught a very important lesson to middle-class people.
Christmas. Nonsense. Humbug.
Because the Christmas season presented them with a real problem. What do we owe to the different people in our world? What do we owe to our families? What do we owe to our employees? What do we owe to the anonymous poor?
At first, Ebenezer Scrooge refuses to face those problems, but after his visions of Christmas past, present, and future, Scrooge learns that family and charity cannot be ignored at Christmas time.
Merry Christmas, Bob!
Mr. Scrooge!
And Mrs. Cratchit, for you!
Mr. Scrooge!
My dear, that's for you!
It really is a conversion story, and it's a story about this hard-hearted man being reborn to Christmas observance.
And I'm going to raise your salary and help your large family in every way possible.
That conversion story is important for Victorians to be thinking about their own conversion to the holiday, because it is very much that they are being reconverted. So many of them have given up on the holiday, so now they have to come to terms with their own reconnection with that, and Scrooge is a way of doing that.
There's this lovely story of Dickens going around America on one of his famous reading tours, and this American factory owner going to a reading of Christmas Carol, and on the way home saying to his wife, "Next year, we shall close the factory on Christmas Day."
19th century Americans were discovering Christmas after a 200-year drought of Puritan disapproval. But the holiday would never have taken hold if society wasn't ready for it. One important shift was occurring right inside the family itself.
Before the 19th century, the family existed as what we might think of as an engine of discipline designed to train children to work hard. After 1820, 1830, the family was very quickly and perceptibly becoming an agency that was designed to provide the emotional nursery for children so that they could grow up being sensitive little people who took a lot of pleasure in the family and in the world itself.
Christmas was tailor-made for this transition. Now there was a holiday where attention could be lavished on children without seeming to spoil them.
The moment of Christmas, where parents started to pay attention to their children, I sometimes come to think of this as the invention of quality time within the family. Parents would discover the joy that they could take out of watching the joy in their children's faces when they gave their children presents.
Americans now knew why they were celebrating Christmas, but they didn't know exactly how to go about it. The old pagan revelry was clearly inappropriate for a Victorian home, but some ancient traditions were perfect for reviving. The Christmas tree has its roots in Germany, where decorated evergreens had always been a part of the winter celebrations. But the tree might have stayed there if not for the royal marriage in 1840 of Victoria, the Queen of England, to her cousin, Prince Albert of Germany. Albert brought his German ways to Windsor Palace, including the annual Christmas tree. In 1848, the London Illustrated News published this engraving of the royal family, standing by the first Christmas tree most English had ever seen. In just a few years, a decorated fir could be found in nearly every English home at Christmas.
Within a few years, if you look at Victorian diaries or letters, people are saying, "We had a Christmas tree as is customary," or "We had a Christmas tree as we have always had." And of course, they hadn't always had one at all. It is a custom which had started in the 1840s. By the late 1850s, people believed that the Christmas tree was part of the English Christmas.
Americans embraced the Christmas tree just as quickly as the English had. In fact, its connection to the old world was one of its strongest selling points.
For a lot of Americans, these are going to be new holiday traditions, not something their parents observed, especially in the case of the more austere Protestants. So they're looking for a reason for what they're doing. And one of the most convenient reasons they can have is they can say, well, this is the way it's done in Germany, or this is the way it's done in England.
All of a sudden, Christmas traditions were popping up everywhere. In 1828, Joel R. Poinsett, America's minister to Mexico, brought back a green and red plant that seemed perfect for the new holiday. And in 1843, the English firm of J.C. Horsley printed the first Christmas card. A newly efficient postal service in England and America helped make Christmas cards an overnight sensation. It seemed as though every vestige of the old bacchanalian Christmas was gone, but even the Victorians couldn't clean up Christmas completely.
Victorians were particularly keen on mistletoe because, of course, you could actually kiss a lady, or a lady could kiss a man, that normally, in the normal course of events, you would not be allowed to kiss. So in a society which was fairly strict, one vestige of that licentious Christmas from earlier times is the sprig of mistletoe. No Victorian Christmas gathering was without it.
By mid-century, Christmas was everywhere in America, in the streets, in the homes, in the marketplace. The one place you could not find Christmas was in church. Most Americans were Protestant, and the Protestant church had ignored Christmas for years. But Protestant Victorians longed for official religion on this sacred day.
What a number of them do initially is say, well, if we can't find a Christmas service in our Baptist church or our Presbyterian church, let's go see what the Catholics are doing, or let's go see what the Episcopalians are doing. And increasingly that puts pressure on these Latter-day Puritans to have Christmas services, because there's a way in which lay people begin to expect it.
Church services, mistletoe, and Christmas trees. America's new holiday now seemed firmly in place. But Victorian America had one last contribution to the Christmas season. A jolly elf who shimmied down the chimney would soon personify Christmas for generations to come.
Here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane.
We borrowed the Christmas tree from Germany and the Christmas card from England. But one Christmas icon was developed right here in America, Santa Claus.
Hang your stocking, say your prayers, for Santa Claus comes tonight.
Long before Santa, however, there was Saint Nicholas, a Greek Orthodox bishop who became one of the most popular saints of the Middle Ages. On December 6th, St. Nicholas Day, good children woke to gifts from the kindly saint. Bad children sulked away with nothing. In Holland, he was known as Sinterklaas, and when the Dutch came to this country, they brought tales of their gift-giving Nicholas with them. This quaint custom caught the imagination of Clement Clark Moore, a well-heeled Episcopal minister in New York City. In 1822, Moore wrote a poem for his children about a good-natured saint who came down the chimney on Christmas Eve.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there."
Moore dreamed up Dasher, Dancer, and the rest of the reindeer, along with Santa's entrance through the chimney. But at first he was embarrassed by the poem. He worried it was too frivolous for a man of the church.
Clement Moore was a minister. Here a minister, who should be on the other side, is promoting a secular Christmas with reindeer and all the rest of it. But there was no mention in the poem of anything religious. And in fact, that's why he didn't reveal who he was. In the beginning, he didn't reveal the authorship.
Moore soon owned up to the poem when it became clear that every child in America was scanning the horizon for reindeer on Christmas Eve. Less clear was what exactly this Santa Claus looked like. At first, Santa came in all shapes and sizes. A pagan sorcerer. A frightening gnome. Even a drunkard on a turkey-driven sleigh. Then, in 1863, Thomas Nast, a cartoonist for Harper's Weekly, settled the matter once and for all with his version of the Christmas Saint. Nast Santa was rounder and jollier than his austere Catholic cousin. He looked, in fact, like a man of his times, a man who would fit right in with the rotund, bewhiskered robber barons of the late 19th century. But Santa was a robber baron in reverse.
Instead of taking from the less fortunate, he gave to the less fortunate. He gave to people regardless of whether they'd done something or not. In other words, he gave to children. Instead of gathering together wealth, he gets rid of wealth, and he does it yearly.
A captain of industry with a heart of gold. It's no wonder that by the 1840s, Santa Claus was an irresistible image to America's retailers. Here was a guy who could sell anything at Christmas, but make it seem like you were not buying gifts at all.
Santa Claus provided a way for both children and parents to pretend that Christmas presents were not in the realm of the commercial marketplace, that Christmas presents existed in the realm of pure domestic affection. So Santa Claus played a very important role for both parents and children. He took presents out of the realm of commerce.
If the image of Santa could sell merchandise, retailers soon figured that a real-life Santa would boost sales even further. Santa has been showing up in department stores since the mid-1800s. And since then, nothing has loomed larger to a child at Christmas than this annual pilgrimage.
You want to talk to Santa Claus, where do you go? You go to the shopping mall. Now, this is strange for a saint to be living pretty much full-time in a department store. It doesn't bother Americans because we are, after all, a capitalistic society. It makes perfect sense for us to have our national saint in a department store. That's commercial sense for us, dollars and cents.
Author and humorist Gene Shepherd immortalized this rite of passage in A Christmas Story, an autobiographical account of one boy's Christmas.
You know, I've been thinking for weeks what I wanted for Christmas. I figured the best thing to do is to tell Santa Claus about that. And I looked up at that Santa Claus, and he had these big, watery blue eyes and a huge beard and all, and he's looking at me right in the eye. And he was so impressive that my mind went blank.
Ho, 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 ho. Then what's your name, little boy?
It's like if all of a sudden you're sitting on the president's lap. And he says, what would you like me to pass in legislation, sonny? I mean, your mind's going to go blank. You can't remember any of this stuff. And so at that point, Santa Claus looked at me and he says, all right, how about a football, kid?
How about a nice football?
And football, I wanted a BB gun. So he pushed me off his lap. And this elf grabbed me and threw me down a slide that went down into the snow. And I laid there for a minute, and I knew that I was not a fit person to talk to the great. Santa Claus was obviously a star.
A celebrity of this magnitude obviously needed a sidekick. In 1939, Robert May, a copywriter at the Montgomery Ward department store, dashed off a promotional children's book to lure Christmas shoppers into the store. May's story told of an ostracized reindeer with a big red nose.
Poor Rudolph. Where most reindeer's noses are brownish and tiny, Rudolph's was red, very large, and quite shiny.
This physical, shall I say, disability turns out to be an asset because it's a foggy Christmas Eve.
This fog would be hard to get through.
And this light on the nose enables poor old stumbling Santa Claus to get through.
Then all the reindeer loved him as they shouted out with glee. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer, you'll go down in history.
So you have this handicapped sort of child figure helping the benighted parental figure make Christmas possible.
Rudolph brought Christmas full circle. It was now the children who really made Christmas possible. Only they understood the meaning of this enchanted day.
But first, there's been an overwhelming response to Bill's talking points from last night about the civil rights industry and how some of its leaders refuse to address the real problems in the African-American community.
Right now, the unemployment rate among black males ages 16 and 19, 57%, 57%. It's 25% for white males that age. Overall, black unemployment, 14%. White unemployment, 6.6. The reason? In many poor neighborhoods, there's chaos, violence, and little discipline in the public schools. Kids aren't learning. Also, with the African-American out-of-wedlock birth rate at 73%, many young blacks are unsupervised and prone to imitate bad behavior, like what Lil Wayne puts out.
Papa got a pain pill, about to put rims on my skateboard wheel. Beat that up like Emmett Till.
The parent company of Lil Wayne, Cash Money Content, which markets vile stuff that hurts children, is a partner in distributing Sharpton's upcoming book. That's right. Al Sharpton is in business with people who put out entertainment harmful to children.
So Bill's contention is that the civil rights industry is simply not addressing the core reason why many African Americans are not succeeding in the marketplace. Now, for two other views on this, Georgetown professor Chris Metzler joins us from Davie, Florida, and from L.A., Jasmine Kanick, who writes on issues of politics and race. Okay, Jasmine, let's start with you on this. Bill's made a lot of news over the last week in talking about the Zimmerman verdict, Trayvon Martin, and how the civil rights community of today has responded. What was your reaction to what he said last night, specifically regarding Al Sharpton and this particular hip-hop artist and the kind of stuff he puts out?
All right, Laura, two things. First, looking at the whole Cash Money family and them publishing a book, some people might think that's a step up, okay, because books, unlike music, require people to actually read. So it really depends on how you look at that situation. And as far as Al Sharpton goes, you know, not to be disrespectful, but white people don't get to tell us who our civil rights leaders are or who to look up to. And if you think in any way that Al Sharpton represents the entire gamut in terms of who civil rights leaders are and what issues they're focusing on, you would be wrong. There are other civil rights leaders in America who are addressing all the issues that Bill pointed to in his talking points memo around unemployment, and education and so on and so forth. And I would say to the people who think that Lil Wayne is a problem and is contributing in any way to that, that they should look at what their own engagement and involvement is. All of a sudden, it's like white people care about black America.
Well,
really,
Jasmine, I just want to jump in here because I think the folks are damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, right? If white folks don't engage on issues like this, then you don't really care, right? If you do engage,
it's how you engage.
Well, but look, I think we're having a conversation about language, approach, right? Mutual respect. And I've heard a lot of people calling on my radio show, they happen to be black, who don't like this industry, don't like what it does, don't like what it pumps out, especially to young, impressionable minds. And they're cool people. They're not prudes. They're not like turning off their iPods and not listening to anything. They say, look, we gotta take responsibility for ourselves here. We gotta parent kids better. We've gotta choose our role models and our leaders, our community leaders, in a better fashion. And so I think it's well within folks' rights to say, look, white, black, brown, or whatever, is this really what you want your kids to listen to? And Professor, you can chime in here too. But look, I mean,
sure.
Al Sharpton condemns a lot of these lyrics, but then you see, like, there always seems to be some side deals going on here in the background. I think that's what O'Reilly was getting at.
Yeah, I think he was, and I think he's accurate. But let me just go back to what was just said a moment ago.
White people don't tell us who our civil rights leaders are. Seriously, that's your argument? That's ridiculous. This is not about whether white people are telling us what to do. The fact is that in the African American black community, there are some substantial problems that need to be addressed. This has nothing to do with
white
people
trying
to say.
And white people don't get to lead us
on that.
I'm
not done. You had the opportunity to speak. Thank you. This has nothing to do with white people taking the mantle and telling us what to do. What Bill said was some civil rights leaders. He didn't say all civil rights leaders. And your contention is exactly the problem. Rather than looking at policies, practices, and procedures, you are looking at this strictly through a racial lens. As a result of that, we have been unable to move this conversation anywhere. We had Bill Clinton's conversation on race. We've had all of these kinds of things, and we are still back to where we are. This has nothing to do with white people trying to rule over us. That is a ridiculous, nonsensical argument.
Jasmine, that is your right to feel that. Your right to feel that way, okay? So let me make a couple of points clear. First of all, the major consumers of hip-hop and music like Lil Wayne's aren't African-Americans. Over 70% of the consumers of hip-hop is white America. So maybe we need to change the conversation and ask white America to stop supporting Lil Wayne if you feel that
Great.
He's so detrimental
I'm all for
to
that.
Black families.
Hey, I'm with that.
Okay.
Let's do it.
I'm applauding that.
So,
let's change
the conversation.
Hey, Jasmine,
all right, finally, on something, Laura,
yeah,
finally.
Jasmine, we're almost out of time, but look, there are a couple of things that are real indicators of future success and really decrease your risk of going into poverty. One is if you're in a stable marriage, okay? Two is if you have a good education. So it seems to me that someone like a Sharpton or a Jackson with their platforms and all their, you know, Action Network and all that deal, I mean, if they're out there talking about, hey, if you're married, if you don't have kids out of wedlock, and guys, if you're supporting educational choice, we're going to have more opportunities within our community. We're going to do better. If he's devoted his time to those two issues, marriage and real educational opportunity, i.e. school choice, I think Al Sharpton would make an actual positive difference. And right now, I think he's actually reversing a lot of the progress that's been made between the races. And that, I think, is a real shame for everybody, black, white, and everyone else. But it's great to see you both. Jasmine and Chris, thanks.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link, blacks won't practice group economics, blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up, and I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money and hold that money and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money from the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems, so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You don't. You got about one black TV station, and you, so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly's, they can talk, call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have a, you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know, you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? March in the network.
Most people in the United States today do not know that prior to the turn of the century, we had 95% of the people inside the United States self-employed. But immediately after the turn of the century, we got 95% of the population working for just 5% of the population who just happened to be rich. If you do not follow your own mind and your own thoughts, you will follow the thoughts of the man that followed his. This above scenario is a result of people not minding their own business. For a business of your own to mind, go to www.tahakapowernomics.net. That's T-A-R-H-A-K-A, powernomics.net. Call me, Tahaka Manayel Bay, 904-303-9061. Before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we get you set up in your own business so you can mind your own business.
Okay, Moses, we're back. We won't run the last final segment of the Christmas thing because I think that by now we already got the gist. We know and we've been listening to the fact that this particular culture, this particular custom has absolutely nothing to do with us. So now the only thing that we have to do is wait until the time come, step to the side, and just be observant of who is participating in the acknowledgement and expenditure and expending and paying for, because we've already learned money coming out the pocket is a liability, money going in the pocket is an asset. So that will give us a gist of the overall conditions of what's going on inside the brain of the people. The only people that I'm concerned about looking at is the ones that look like me. That's just my thing. I don't have to argue with anybody. There won't be no debate. I don't have to question anybody because I'm not questioning anybody else. I'll just be observant so I can look at the overall conditions across the board. Now, one of the most interesting scenarios that I read when I was doing my research is I looked at the story of King David. King David had some peace, but then war erupted. But he had a general. Now, this particular general here was one of the most fierce men, in my opinion, and the greatest military strategist that I had ever seen. But David had a son that he was trying to groom into being the man that he was. And David had issued a decree, order, that they were supposed to go at this army from a particular position, a particular way, a particular everything. That decree went out across the land. And he gave his son charge of making sure that this particular decree was followed to the letter. But when his son went over to the main general and told the general that my father said that we're supposed to go here, and the general told him, say, well, no, we can't do that. Because if we do that, we're going to lose over here and this, that, and the other. He said, yes, but my father said, he said, I say that we're going to go over here and do this, that, and the other. So now we have a situation. We have one man who was king of the entire land, who had picked the greatest men on the planet to be his protection. He has a son that he's trying to groom as a man. But the son went to the general that had a different opinion than the king of the land. So the son said, I'm going back and tell my father. But the man said nothing. And he went back and told his father, and said, I told all the people to do what they told to do, but Absalom say he's not going to do what you say. He's going to go over there. He said, what did Absalom tell you? He said, Absalom said he's going to go there, and this is not what you told me. He said, whatever he told you to do, that is what we will do. Amazing. Nevertheless, both men were in charge of their own brain. We have a president of the United States. He say that we're going to have Obamacare. All the men across the land, all the women across the land, all the children across the land has to get Obamacare. But my question is very, very simple. I'm nobody. But me personally, I don't think that I need that. That's just my opinion. And that's based on what I know about my own self and my own culture and you know all that stuff and what I can present as evidence and proof beyond the shadow, any shadow of a doubt that I don't need it. That's just me. So now, something different. And you don't have to be surprised because you run into that all the time, every day, in every single instance, all across the United States. Most of us run into that, but we don't know that we are running into it. And the reason why we don't know, because we have not defined for ourselves, our own identity, our own knowledge of self, and what we are prepared to do based on what we know and can prove and back up and defend and carry out to the letter so that there can be no misunderstanding. There can be no disillusion. There is no misunderstanding. There is no confusion about nothing, because this is what we can prove. That's just the way I see it. I don't mean to be crude. I'm not trying to be disrespectful or anything. You know, I just look in the facts in the face of facts. I mean, after all, I have a brain inside a skull that's attached to my shoulders. And I need somebody to prove beyond any shadow of a doubt where I'm supposed to lease it, rent it, or loan it to anybody else for control. If you can do that for me and prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that is what I'm supposed to be doing, then what I'm going to do at that point is I'm going to look at you and see the results and the overall results of what you have done to accomplish the change of the world. Because if you write all the manifestations of what you're telling me, has to be absolute, and I shouldn't have to ask any question. I should look around and see that you are correct. After all, we say, well, the Creator created heaven and earth. There's no doubt in anybody's mind that it had to be somebody did it right here. It just didn't happen out of anybody. So everybody looking at God, ain't they? Okay. Well, then, well, the same scenario applies to somebody who's trying to gain control of your lease or your rent or control of the brain. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope we got something out of this. I just want you to think about it just a little bit. Just a little bit. Not a whole lot. Just a little bit. I've been your host, Targon Monoyo Bay. Until next time, y'all have a good evening. Okay, Mo, good night.
If she knows she